longest I'd ever stayed anywhere voluntarily. I should stay forever. With Roscoe. Because she was good for me. I was beginning to imagine a future with her. It felt good. But there were going to be problems. When Kleiner's dirty money was taken out, the whole town was going to fall apart. There wouldn't be any place left to stay around in. And I had to wander, like the song I was singing in my head. I had to ramble, a traditional song, a song that could have been written for me. In my heart, I believed Blind Blake had made it up. He had wandered. He had walked right by this place when the concrete pillars were old shade trees. 60 years ago, he had walked down the road I was watching, maybe singing the song I was singing. Joe and I used to sing that old song. We'd sing it as an ironic comment on army family life. We'd stumble off a plane somewhere and ride to an airless, empty base house. 20 minutes after moving in, we'd start up singing that song. Like, we'd been there long enough and we were ready to move on again. So I leaned back on the concrete pillar and sang it for him, as well as for me. Took me 35 minutes to run through every version of that old song, once for me and once for Joe. During that time, I saw maybe a half dozen trucks pull into the warehouse approach. All local guys, all little dusty Georgia trucks. Nothing with long-haul grime blasted all over it. Nothing headed for the end building. I sang softly for 35 minutes and picked up no information at all. But I did get some applause. I finished the last song and heard a slow, ironic hand clap coming out of the darkness behind me. I whipped around the broad concrete pillar and stared into the gloom. The clapping stopped, and I heard a shuffling sound, picked up the vague shape of a man crawling toward me. The shape firmed up, some kind of a hobo, long gray matted hair, and layers of heavy clothing. Bright eyes, burning in a seamed and dirty face. The guy stopped out of reach. "Who the hell are you?" I asked him. He swiped his curtain of hair aside and grinned at me.
"Who the hell are you?" he said. "Coming to my place and bawling like that?"
"This is your place?" I said. "You live under here?" He settled on his haunches and shrugged at me.
"Temporarily," he said. "Been here a month. You got a problem with that?"
I shook my head. I had no problem with that. The guy had to live somewhere. "Sorry to disturb you," I said. "I'll be out of here by tonight." His smell was drifting over to me. Wasn't pleasant. This guy smelled like he'd been on the road all his life.
"Stay as long as you like," he said. "We just decided to move on. We're vacating the premises."
"We?" I said. "There's somebody else here?" The guy looked at me oddly, turned, and pointed to the air beside him. There was nobody there. My eyes had adjusted to the gloom. I could see all the way back to the concrete cantilever under the elevated road, just empty space.
"My family," he said. "We're pleased to meet you, but we gotta go. Time to move on."
He reached behind him and dragged the canvas kit bag out of the gloom. Army issue. There was a faint stencil on it. PFC something with a serial number and a unit designation. He pulled it up close and shuffled away. "Wait up," I said. "Were you here last week? Thursday?" The guy stopped and half turned back.
"Been here a month," he said. "Didn't see anything last Thursday."
I looked at him and his kit bag. A soldier. Soldiers don't volunteer anything. Their basic rule. So I eased off the concrete and pulled a candy bar out of my pocket, wrapped it in a $100 bill, tossed it over to him. He caught it and put it in his coat, nodded to me silently. "So, what didn't you see last Thursday?" I asked him. He shrugged.
"I didn't see anything," he said. "That's the honest truth. But my wife did. She saw plenty of things."
"Okay," I said slowly. "Will you ask her what things she saw?" He nodded, turned, and had a whispered conversation with the air beside him, turned back to me.
"She saw aliens," he said. "An enemy starship, disguised like a shiny black truck. Two aliens, disguised like regular Earth guys in it. She saw lights in the sky. Smoke. Spaceship comes down, turns into a big car. Starfleet commander comes out dressed as a cop. Short, fat guy. Then a white car comes off the highway, but it's really a starfighter landing. Two guys in it. Earth guys. Pilot and co-pilot. They all do a dance right there by the gate because they come from another galaxy. She said it was exciting. She loves that stuff. Sees it everywhere she goes." He nodded at me. He meant it. "I missed the whole thing," he said, gestured to the air beside him. "The baby needed a bath. But that's what my wife saw. She loves that stuff."
"She hear anything?" I asked him. He asked her, got her reply, and shook his head like I was crazy.
"Space beings don't make sound," he said. "But the starfighter co-pilot got all shot up with stun phases, crawled in here later, bled to death, right where you're sitting. We tried to help him, but there's really nothing you can do about stun phases, right? The medics got him out Sunday."
I nodded. He crawled off, dragging his kit bag. I watched him go, and then slid back around the pillar, watched the road, picked through his wife's story. An eyewitness report. The guy wouldn't have convinced the Supreme Court, but he sure as hell convinced me. It wasn't the Supreme Court's brother who had flown down in a starfighter and done a dance at the warehouse gate. It was another hour before anything showed up. I had eaten a candy bar and sipped most of a pint of water. I was just sitting and waiting. A decent-sized panel truck rolled in, coming south. It slowed up at the warehouse approach. I saw New York commercial plates through the field glasses, dirty white rectangles. The truck nosed along the tarmac and waited at the fourth gate. The guys in the compound swung open the gate and signaled the truck through. It stopped again, and the two guys swung the gate shut behind it. Then the driver backed up to the roller door and stopped, got out of the truck. One of the gate men climbed into the truck, and the other ducked into a side door and cranked the roller open. The truck backed into the dark, and the roller came down again. The New York driver was left on the forecourt, stretching in the sun. That was it. About 30 seconds, beginning to end, nothing on show. I watched and waited. The truck was in there 18 minutes. Then the roller door winched open again, and the gate man drove the truck back out. As soon as it was clear, the roller came down again, and the gate man jumped down from the cab. The New York guy hoisted himself back into the seat while the gate man ran ahead to swing the gates. The truck passed through and rattled out and back onto the county road. It turned north and passed by 20 yards from where I was leaning up on the concrete overpass pillar. It swung onto the on-ramp and roared up to join the northbound traffic stream. Pretty much straight away, another truck was rumbling down the off-ramp, leaving the traffic stream coming down from the north. It was a similar truck. Same make, same size, same highway grime. It lumbered and bounced into the warehouse approach. I squinted through the field glasses. Illinois plates. It went through the same ritual. Paused at the gates, backed up to the roller door. The driver was replaced by the gate man. The roller came up just long enough to swallow the truck into the gloom inside, quick and efficient. About 30 seconds again, beginning to end. And secret. The long-haul drivers weren't allowed into the warehouse. They had to wait outside. The Illinois truck was out quicker. 16 minutes. The driver reclaimed his place at the wheel and headed out, back to the highway. I watched him pass by, 20 yards away. Our theory said both trucks had been loaded up with some of the stockpile and were grinding their way north, thundering their way back to the big cities up there, ready to unload. So far, our theory looked good. I couldn't fault it. The next hour, nothing happened. The fourth compound stayed closed up tight. I started to get bored. I started to wish the hobo hadn't left. We could have chatted a while. Then I saw the third truck of the day come heading in. I raised the field glasses and saw California plates. Same type of truck, dirty red color, rumbling in off the highway heading for the end compound. It went through a different routine from the first two. It went in through the gates, but there was no change of driver. The truck just reversed straight in through the roller door. This guy was obviously authorized to see inside the shed. Then a wait. I timed it at 22 minutes. Then the roller door winched up and the truck came back out. Drove straight back out through the gates and headed for the highway. I took a fast decision. Time to go. I wanted to see inside one of those trucks. So I scrambled to my feet and grabbed the field glasses and the water canteen, ran under the overpass to the northbound side, clawed my way up the steep bank and leapt the concrete wall back to the old Cadillac. I slammed the hood shut and got in, started up and rolled along the shoulder. Waited for a gap and gunned the big motor, nudged the wheel, and accelerated north. I figured the red truck might be 3 or 4 minutes ahead. Not much more than that. I hopped past bunches of vehicles and pushed the big old car on, then settled back to a fast cruise. I figured I was gaining all the time. After a few miles, I spotted the truck. Eased off and sat well back, maybe 300 yards behind him. Kept a half dozen vehicles between him and me. I settled back and relaxed. We were going to L.A., according to Roscoe's menorah theory. We cruised slowly north, not much more than 50 miles an hour. The Cadillac's tank was near enough full. Might get me 300 miles, maybe 350. At this slow cruise, maybe more. Acceleration was the killer. Gunning the worn 8-year-old V8 would use gas faster than coffee comes out of a pot. But a steady cruise would give me reasonable mileage. Might get me up to 400 miles. Enough to get as far west as Memphis, maybe. We rolled on. The dirty red truck sat up. Big and obvious, 300 yards ahead. It bore left around the southern fringe of Atlanta, setting itself to strike out west, across the country. The distribution theory was looking good. I slowed down and hung back through the interchange. Didn't want the driver to get suspicious about being followed. But I could see by the way he was handling his lane changes This was not a guy who made much use of his rearview mirrors. I closed up a little tighter. The red truck rolled on. I stayed 8 cars behind it. Time rolled by. It got late in the afternoon. It got to be early evening. I ate candy and sipped water for dinner as I drove. I couldn't work the radio. It was some kind of a fancy Japanese make. The guy at the auto shop must have transplanted it. Maybe it was busted. I wondered how he was doing with tinting the Bentley's windows. I wondered what Charlie was going to say about getting her car back with black glass. I figured maybe that was going to be the least of her worries. We rolled on. We rolled on for almost 400 miles. 8 hours. We drove out of Georgia, right through Alabama, into the northeast corner of Mississippi. It got pitch dark. The fall sun had dropped away up ahead. People had switched their lights on. We drove on through the dark for hours. It felt like I had been following the guy all my life. Then, approaching midnight, the red truck slowed down. A half mile ahead, I saw it pull off into a truck stop in the middle of nowhere, near a place called Myrtle, maybe 60 miles short of the Tennessee state line, maybe 70 miles shy of Memphis. I followed the truck into the lot, parked up well away from it. I saw the driver get out, a tall, thick-set type of a guy, thick neck and wide, powerful shoulders, dark, in his 30s, long arms, like an ape. I knew who he was. He was Kleiner's son, a stone-cold psychopath. I watched him. He did some stretching and yawning in the dark, standing by his truck. I stared at him and pictured him Thursday night at the warehouse gate, dancing. The Kleiner kid locked up the truck and ambled off toward the buildings. I waited a spell and followed him. I figured he would have gone straight for the bathroom, so I hung around the newsstand in the bright neon and watched the door. I saw him come out and watched him amble into the diner area. He settled at a table and stretched again. Picked up the menu with the expansive air of a guy who was taking his time. He was there for a late dinner. I figured he'd take 25 minutes, maybe a half hour. I headed back out to the parking lot. I wanted to break into the red truck and get a look inside, but I saw there was no chance of doing it out there in the lot. No chance at all. People were walking around, and a couple of police cruisers were loafing about. The whole place was lit up with bright lights. Breaking into that truck was going to have to wait. I walked back to the buildings, crammed myself into a phone booth, and dialed the station house in Margrave. Finlay answered right away. I heard his deep Harvard tones. He had been sitting by the phone, waiting for me to check in. "Where are you?" he said. "Not far from Memphis," I said. "I watched a truck load up, and I'm sticking with it until I get a chance to look inside. The driver's the Kleiner kid." "Okay," he said. "I heard from Picard. Roscoe's safely installed. Fast asleep now, if she's got any sense. He said she sends her love." "Send mine back if you get the chance," I said. "Take care, Harvard guy. Take care yourself," he said. Hung up. I strolled back to the Cadillac, got in and waited. It was a half hour before the Kleiner kid came out again. I saw him walk back toward the red truck. He was wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. Looked like he'd had a good dinner. Certainly taken him long enough. He walked out of sight. A minute later, the truck rattled by and lurched onto the exit road. But the kid didn't head back to the highway. He ducked a left onto a service road. He was going around to the motel. He was going to stay overnight. He drove right up to the row of motel cabins, parked the red truck up against the second cabin from the end, right in the glow of a big light on a pole. He got out and locked up, took a key from his pocket and opened up the cabin, went in and shut the door. I saw the light go on and the blind come down. He had had the key in his pocket. He hadn't gone into the office. He must have booked the room when he was inside for dinner. He must have paid for it and picked up the key. That's what had taken him so damn long in there. It gave me a problem. I needed to see inside the truck. I needed the evidence. I needed to know I was in the right, and I needed to know soon. Sunday was 48 hours away. I had things to do before Sunday. A lot of things. I was going to have to break into the truck right there in the glare of the light on the pole, while the psychopathic Kleiner kid was 10 feet away in his motel room. Not the safest thing in the world to do. I was going to have to wait a while to do it, until the kid was sound asleep and wouldn't hear the boom and scrape as I went to work. I waited a half hour. Couldn't wait any more. I started the old Cadillac and moved it through the stillness. The tappets were out and the pistons were slapping. The motor was making a hell of a noise in the silence. I parked the car tight up to the red truck, nose in, facing the kid's motel room door. I climbed out across the passenger seat, stood still and listened. Nothing. I took Morrison's switchblade from my jacket pocket and stepped up onto the Cadillac's front fender, stepped onto the hood and up over the windshield, up onto the Cadillac's roof, stood still, up high, listened hard. Nothing. I leaned over to the truck and hauled myself upward onto its roof. A panel truck like that has a translucent roof. It's some kind of a fiberglass sheet. They make the roof out of it, or at least a sort of skylight set into the sheet metal. It's there to let a dim light down into the cargo area. Helps with loading and unloading. Maybe it's lighter in weight. Maybe cheaper. Manufacturer will do anything to save a buck. The roof is the best way into a truck like that. My upper body was flat on the fiberglass panel, and my feet were scrabbling for the Cadillac's gutter. I reached out as far as I could and sprang the switchblade, stabbed it down through the plastic panel right in the center of the roof, used the blade to saw a flap about 10 inches deep, 18 inches wide. I could push it down and peer in, like looking down through a shallow slot. The light in the motel room snapped on. The window blind threw a yellow square of light out over the Cadillac, over the side of the red truck, over my legs. I grunted and pushed off, swam out onto the truck's roof, lay flat and silent, held my breath. The motel room door opened. The Kleiner kid came out, stared at the Cadillac, stooped and looked inside, walked around and checked the truck, checked the cab doors, tugged the handles. The vehicle shook and rocked under me. He walked around to the back and tried the rear doors, tugged the handles. I heard the doors rattle against their locks. He walked the circuit of the truck. I lay there and listened to the crack of his footsteps below. He checked the Cadillac again. Then he went back inside. The room door slammed, the lights snapped off. The yellow square of light died. I waited 5 minutes. Just lay there up on the roof and waited. Then I hauled myself up onto my elbows. Reached for the slot in the fiberglass that I had just cut. Forced the flap down and hooked my fingers in. Dragged myself over and peered through. The truck was empty. Totally empty. Nothing in it at all. 24. It was over 400 miles back to the Margrave station house. I drove all of them as fast as I dared. I needed to see Finley, needed to lay out a brand new theory for him. I slotted the old Cadillac into a space right next to Teal's brand new model, went inside and nodded to the desk guy. He nodded back. "Finley here?" I asked him.
"In back," he told me. "The mayor's with him."
I skirted the reception counter and ran through the squad room to the Rosewood office. Finley was in there with Teal. Finley had bad news for me. I could see it in the slope of his shoulders. Teal looked at me, surprised.
"You back in the army, Mr. Reacher?" he said.
Took me a second to catch on. He was talking about my fatigues and the camouflage jacket. I looked him up and down. He was in a shiny gray suit with embroidered patterns all over it, bootlace tie with a silver clasp.
"Don't you be talking to me about clothes, asshole," I said.
He looked down at himself in surprise, brushed off a speck that hadn't been there, glared up at me.
"I could have you arrested for language like that," he said.
"And I could tear your head off," I said to him. "And then I could stick it up your ratty old ass." We stood and glared at each other for what seemed like a long time. Teal gripped his heavy cane like he wanted to raise it up and hit me with it. I could see his hand tightening around it and his glance darting toward my head. But in the end, he just stalked out of the office and slammed the door. I reopened it a crack and peered out after him. He was picking up a phone at one of the squad room desks. He was going to call Kleiner. He was going to ask him when the hell he was going to do something about me. I shut the door again and turned to Finley. "What's the problem?" I asked him.
"Serious shit," he said. "But did you get a look in the truck?"
"I'll get to that in a minute," I said. "What's the problem here?"
"You want the small problem first," he said, "or the big problem?"
"Small first," I said.
"Picard's keeping Roscoe another day," he said.
"No option."
"Shit," I said. "I wanted to see her."
"She happy with that?"
"According to Picard, she is,"
he said. "Shit," I said again. "So what's the big problem?"
"Somebody's ahead of us," he whispered.
"Ahead of us?" I asked him. "What do you mean?"
"Your brother's list," he said. "The initials and the note about Sherman Stoller's garage. First thing is, there's a telex in from the Atlanta PD this morning. Stoller's house burned down in the night, out by the golf course, where you went with Roscoe. Totally destroyed, garage and all. Torched. Somebody threw gasoline all over the place."
"Christ," I said. "What about Judy?"
"Neighbor says she bailed out Tuesday night," he said. "Right after you spoke to her. Hasn't been back. The house was empty."
I nodded. "Judy's a smart woman," I said. "But that doesn't put them ahead of us. We already saw the inside of the garage. If they were trying to hide something, they were too late. Nothing to hide anyway, right?"
"The initials," he said. "The colleges? I identified the Princeton guy this morning. W.B. was Walter Bartholomew, professor. He was killed last night outside his house."
"Shit," I said. "Killed how?"
"Stabbed," he said. "Jersey police are calling it a mugging. But we know better than that, right?"
"Any more good news?" I asked him. He shook his head.
"Gets worse," he said. "Bartholomew knew something. They got to him before he could talk to us. They're ahead of us, Reacher."
"He knew something?" I said.
"What?"
"Don't know," Finlay said. "When I called the number, I got some research assistant guy, works for Bartholomew. Seems Bartholomew was excited about something, stayed at his office late last night, working. This assistant guy was ferrying him all kinds of old material. Bartholomew was checking it through. Late on, he packed up, emailed Joe's computer, and went home. He ran into the mugger, and that was that.
What did the email say? I asked him.
It said, "Stand by for a call in the morning," he told me. The assistant guy said it felt like Bartholomew had hit on something important.
Shit, I said again.
What about the New York initials, KK?
Don't know yet, he said.
I'm guessing it's another professor, if they haven't gotten to him yet.
Okay, I said.
I'm going to New York to find him.
Why the panic? Finley asked. Was there a problem with the truck?
There was one major problem, I said. The truck was empty. There was silence in the office for a long moment.
It was going back? Empty?
Finley said. I got a look inside just after I called you, I said. It was empty. Nothing in it at all, just fresh air.
Christ, he said.
He looked upset. He couldn't believe it. He had admired Roscoe's distribution theory. He had congratulated her, shook her hand. The menorah shape. It was a good theory. It was so good he couldn't believe it was wrong.
We've got to be right, he said. It makes so much sense.
Think of what Roscoe said. Think of the map. Think of Gray's figures. It all fits together. It's so obvious. I can just about feel it. I can just about see it. It's a traffic flow. It can't be anything else. I've been over it so many times.
Roscoe was right, I agreed. And everything you just said is right. The menorah shape is right. Margrave is the center. It's a traffic flow. We only got one little detail wrong.
What detail? He said.
We got the direction wrong, I said. We got it as backward. The flow goes exactly the opposite direction. Same shape, but it's flowing down here, not out of here.
He nodded. He saw it.
So they're not loading up here, he said.
They're unloading here. They're not dispersing a stockpile, they're building up a stockpile. Right here in Margrave.
But a stockpile of what?
You're certain they're not printing money somewhere and bringing it down here? I shook my head.
Doesn't make any sense, I said.
Molly said there's no printing going on in the States. Joe stopped it.
So what are they bringing down here? He said.
We need to figure that out, I said. But we know it adds up to about a ton a week, and we know it fits into air conditioner boxes.
We do?
Finlay said. That's what changed last year, I said. Before last September, they were smuggling it out of the country. That's what Sherman Stoller was doing. The air conditioner runs weren't a decoy operation. They were the actual operation itself. They were exporting something boxed up in air conditioner cartons. Sherman Stoller was driving them down to Florida every day to meet a boat. That's why he got so uptight when he was flagged down for speeding. That's why the fancy lawyer came running over. Not because he was on his way to load up, because he was on his way to unload. He had the Jacksonville police sniffing around a full load for 55 minutes.
But a full load of what? Finlay said.
I don't know, I said. The cops didn't think to look. They saw a load of sealed-up air conditioner cartons, brand new, serial numbers and everything, and they just assumed it was kosher. The air conditioner cartons were damn good cover. Very plausible product to be hauling south. Nobody would be suspicious of brand new air conditioners heading south, right?
But they stopped a year ago, he said.
Correct, I said.
They knew the Coast Guard thing was coming, so they got as much out as they could ahead of time. Remember the double runs in Gray's notes? Then they stopped altogether a year ago, because they felt just as vulnerable smuggling outward past the Coast Guard as we figured they'd feel smuggling inward. Finlay nodded, looked displeased with himself.
"We missed that," he said.
"We missed a lot of things," I said. "They fired Sherman Stoller because they didn't need him anymore. They decided just to sit on the stuff and wait for the Coast Guard thing to stop. That's why they're vulnerable right now. That's why they're panicking, Finlay. It's not the last remains of a stockpile they got in there until Sunday. It's the whole damn thing." Finlay stood guard at the office door. I sat at the Rosewood desk and called Columbia University in New York. The number reached the Modern History Department. The early part of the call was very easy. I got a helpful woman in their administrative office. I asked if they had a professor with the initials KK. Straight away, she identified a guy called Kelvin Kelstein. Been there many years. Sounded like he was a very eminent type of a guy. Then the call got very difficult. I asked if he would come to the phone. The woman said no, he wouldn't. He was very busy and could not be disturbed again. "Again?" I said. "Who's been disturbing him already?"
"Two detectives from Atlanta, Georgia," she said.
"When was this?" I asked her.
"This morning," she said. "They came in here asking for him, and they wouldn't take no for an answer."
"Can you describe these two men to me?" I asked her. There was a pause as she tried to remember.
"They were Hispanic," she said. "I don't recall any details. The one who did the talking was very neat, very polite. Unremarkable, really, I'm afraid."
"Have they met with him yet?" I asked her.
"They made a 1 o'clock appointment," she said. "They're taking him to lunch somewhere, I believe."
I held the phone tighter. "Okay," I said. "This is very important. Did they ask for him by name, or by the initials KK, like I just did?"
"They asked exactly the same question you did," she said. "They asked if we had any faculty with those initials."
"Listen to me," I said. "Listen very carefully. I want you to go see Professor Kelstein. Right now. Interrupt him, whatever he's doing. Tell him this is life or death. Tell him those Atlanta detectives are bogus. They were at Princeton last night, and they murdered Professor Walter Bartholomew."
"Are you kidding?"
the woman said, almost a scream. "This is for real," I said. "My name is Jack Reacher. I believe Kelstein had been in touch with my brother, Joe Reacher, from the Treasury Department. Tell him my brother was murdered also." The woman paused again, swallowed, then she came back, calm.
"What should I tell Professor Kelstein to do?" she said.
"Two things," I said. "First, he must not, repeat, must not meet with the two Hispanic men from Atlanta. At any time. Got that?"
"Yes," she said.
"Good," I said. "Second, he must go right now to the campus security office. Right now, okay? He must wait there for me. I'll be there in about 3 hours. Kelstein must sit in the security office and wait for me with a guard right next to him until I get there. Can you make absolutely sure he does that?"
"Yes,"
she said again. "Tell him to call Princeton from the security office," I said. "Tell him to ask after Bartholomew. That should convince him."
"Yes," the woman said again. "I'll make sure he does what you say."
"And give my name to your security desk," I said. "I don't want any problem getting in when I arrive. Professor Kelstein can ID me. Tell him I look like my brother." I hung up, shouted across the room to Finlay. "They've got Joe's list," I said. They've got two guys up in New York. One of them is the same guy who got Joe's briefcase. Neat, polite guy. They've got the list. But how? He said. The list wasn't in the briefcase. A clang of fear hit me. I knew how. It was staring me in the face. Baker, I said. Baker's inside the scam. He made an extra Xerox copy. You sent him to copy Joe's list, he made two copies and gave one to Teal. Christ, Finlay said. Are you sure? I nodded. There were other indications, I said. Teal's pulled a bluff. We figured everybody in the department was clean, but he was just keeping them hidden. So now we don't know who the hell is involved and who the hell isn't. We've got to get out of here, right now. Let's go. We ran out of the office, through the squad room, out through the big plate glass doors and into Finlay's car. Where to? He said. Atlanta, I told him. The airport. I've got to get to New York. He started up and headed out north along the county road. Baker was in it from the start, I said. It was staring me in the face. I went through it with him as he drove, step by step. Last Friday, I had been alone in the small white interview room at the station house with Baker. I had held out my wrists to him. He had removed my handcuffs. He had taken the cuffs off a guy he was supposed to believe was a murderer. A murderer who had pulped his victim's body. He was willing to put himself alone in a room with such a guy. Then later, I had called him over and made him escort me to the bathroom. He had been sloppy and careless. I'd had opportunities to disarm him and escape. I'd taken it as a sign he had listened to me, answering Finley's questions and slowly become convinced I was innocent. But he'd always known I was innocent. He knew exactly who was innocent and exactly who wasn't. That's why he had been so casual. He knew I was just a convenient fall guy. He knew I was just an innocent passerby. Who worries about taking the cuffs off an innocent passerby? Who takes a whole lot of precautions escorting an innocent passerby to the bathroom? And he had brought Hubble in for questioning. I had noticed his body language. He was all twisted up with conflict. I had figured he was feeling awkward because Hubble was Stevenson's buddy and his relative by marriage. But it wasn't that. He was all twisted up because he was caught in a trap. He knew bringing Hubble in was a disaster, but he couldn't disobey Finlay without alerting him. He was trapped. Damned if he did, damned if he didn't. And there had been a deliberate attempt to conceal Joe's identity. Baker had deliberately screwed up the Prince thing with the computer so that Joe would remain unidentified. He knew Joe was a government investigator. He knew Joe's Prince would be in the Washington database. So he tried to make damn sure they didn't get matched. But he had blown his cover by announcing the null result far too early. It was inexperience. He'd always left the technical work to Roscoe, so he didn't know the system. But I hadn't put two and two together. I had been too overwhelmed when the second attempt with the Prince had brought back my brother's name. Since then, he had been poking and prying, hovering around on the edge of our hidden investigation. He had wanted in, and he had been a willing helper. Finlay had used him on lookout duty, and all the time he was running to Teal with the snippets he was getting from us. Finlay was blasting north at a hell of a speed. He flung the Chevy around the cloverleaf and mashed the pedal. The big car hurtled forward up the highway.
"Could we try the Coast Guard?" he said. "Get them to stand by Sunday for when they start shipping out some kind of an extra patrol?"
"You're joking," I said. The political flack the president's taken over that, he's not going to reverse himself the very first day just because you ask him to.
So what do we do? He said.
Call Princeton back, I told him. Get hold of that research assistant again. He may be able to piece together what Bartholomew figured out last night. Hole up somewhere safe and get busy. He laughed.
Where the hell's safe now? He said.
I told him to use the Alabama motel we had used Monday. It was in the middle of nowhere, and it was as safe as he needed to get. I told him I'd find him there when I got back. Asked him to bring the Bentley to the airport and to leave the key and the parking claim at the arrivals information desk. He repeated all the arrangements back to me to confirm he was solid. He was doing more than 90 miles an hour, but he was turning his head to look at me every time he spoke.
"Watch the road, Finley," I said. "No good to anybody if you kill us in a damn car."
He grinned and faced forward, jammed his foot down harder. The big police Chevy eased up over 100. Then he turned again and looked straight into my eyes for about 300 yards.
"Coward," he said.
25. No easy way to get through the airport security hoops with a sap and a knife and a big metal gun. So I left my camouflage jacket in Finley's car and told him to transfer it to the Bentley. He ducked into departures with me and put the best part of $700 on his credit card for my round-trip ticket on Delta to New York. Then he took off to find the Alabama Motel, and I went through to the gate for the plane to LaGuardia. I was airborne for a shade over 2 hours and in a cab for 35 minutes. Arrived in Manhattan just after 4:30. I had been there in May, and it looked pretty much the same in September. The summer heat was over, and the city was back to work. The cab took me over the Triborough Bridge and headed west on 116th, slid around Morningside Park, and dropped me at Columbia University's main entrance. I went in and found my way to the campus security office, knocked on the glass. A campus policeman checked the clipboard and let me in. Led me through to a room in back and pointed to Professor Kelvin Kelstein. I saw a very old guy, tiny, wizened with age, sporting a huge shock of white hair. He looked exactly like that cleaner I'd seen on the third floor at Warburton, except he was white. "The two Hispanic guys been back?" I asked the college cop. He shook his head. "Haven't seen them," he said. "The old guy's office told them that the lunch date was canceled. Maybe they went away." "I hope so," I said. "Meanwhile, you're going to have to watch over this guy for a spell. Give it until Sunday."
"Why?" he said. "What's going on?"
"Not sure exactly," I said. "I'm hoping the old guy can tell me." The guard walked us back to Kelstein's own office and left us there. It was a small and untidy room crammed full to the ceiling with books and thick journals. Kelstein sat in an old armchair and gestured me to sit opposite him in another.
"What exactly happened to Bartholomew?" he asked.
"I don't know exactly," I said. "Jersey police say he got stabbed during a mugging outside his home."
"But you remain skeptical?" Kelstein asked.
"My brother made a list of contacts," I said. "You're the only one of them still alive."
"Your brother was Mr. Joe Reacher?" he said.
I nodded. "He was murdered last Thursday," I said. "I'm trying to find out why." Kelstein inclined his head and peered out of a grimy window.
"I'm sure you know why," he said. "He was an investigator. Clearly he was killed in the course of an investigation. What you need to know is what he was investigating." Can you tell me what that was? I said.
The old professor shook his head.
Only in the most general terms, he said. I can't help you with specifics.
Didn't he discuss specifics with you? I said.
Nah, he used me as a sounding board, he said. We were speculating together.
I enjoyed it tremendously.
Your brother Joe was a stimulating companion. He had a keen mind and a very attractive precision in the manner in which he expressed himself. It was a pleasure to work with him.
But you didn't discuss specifics, I said again. Kelstein cupped his hands like a man holding an empty vessel.
We discussed everything, he said. But we came to no conclusions.
Okay, I said. Can we start at the beginning? The discussion was about counterfeit currency, right?
Kelstein tilted his great head to one side, looked amused.
Obviously, he said. What else would Mr. Joe Reacher and I find to discuss?
Why you? I asked him bluntly.
The old professor smiled a modest smile which faded into a frown. Then he came up with an ironic grin.
Because I am the biggest counterfeiter in history, he said. I was going to say I was one of the two biggest in history, but after the events of last night at Princeton, sadly now I alone remain.
You and Bartholomew? I said.
You were counterfeiters?
The old guy smiled again.
Not by choice, he said. During the Second World War, young men like Walter and me ended up with strange occupations. He and I were considered more useful in an intelligence role than in combat. We were drafted into the SIS, which, as you know, was the very earliest incarnation of the CIA. Other people were responsible for attacking the enemy with guns and bombs. We were handed the job of attacking the enemy with economics. We derived a scheme for shattering the Nazi economy with an assault on the value of its paper currency. Our project manufactured hundreds of billions of counterfeit Reichsmarks. Spare bombers littered Germany with them. They came down out of the sky like confetti.
Did it work? I asked him.
Yes and no, he said. Certainly their economy was shattered. Their currency was worthless very quickly. But of course, much of their production used slave labor. Slaves aren't interested one way or the other whether the content of somebody else's wage packet is worth anything. And, of course, alternative currencies were found. Chocolate, cigarettes, anything. Altogether, it was only a partial success. But it left Walter and me two of history's greatest forgers. That is, if you use sheer volume as a measure. I can't claim any great talent for the inky end of the process.
So Joe was picking your brains? I asked him.
Walter and I became obsessed, Kelstein said. We studied the history of money forging. It started the day after paper money was first introduced. It's never gone away. We became experts. We carried on the interest after the war. We developed a loose relationship with the government. Finally, some
Years ago, a Senate subcommittee commissioned a report from us. With all due modesty, I can claim that it became the Treasury's anti-counterfeiting Bible. Your brother was familiar with it, of course. That's why he was talking to Walter and me. But what was he talking to you about? I said. Joe was a new broom, Kelstein said. He was brought in to solve problems. He was a very talented man indeed. His job was to eradicate counterfeiting. Now, that's an impossible job. Walter and I told him that. But he nearly succeeded. He thought hard and he applied strokes of appealing simplicity. He just about halted all illicit printing within the United States. I sat in his crowded office and listened to the old guy. Kelstein had known Joe better than I had. He had shared Joe's hopes and plans, celebrated his successes, sympathized over his setbacks. They had talked at length, animatedly, sparking off each other. The last time I had spoken to Joe face to face was very briefly after our mother's funeral. I hadn't asked him what he was doing. I had just seen him as my older brother, just seen him as Joe. I hadn't seen the reality of his life as a senior agent, with hundreds of people under him, trusted by the White House to solve big problems, capable of impressing a smart old bird like Kelstein. I sat there in the armchair and felt bad. I'd lost something I never knew I'd had.
His systems were brilliant, Kelstein said. His analysis was acute. He targeted ink and paper. In the end, it all boils down to ink and paper, doesn't it? If anybody bought the sort of ink or paper that could be used to forge a banknote, Joe's people knew within hours. He swept people up within days. Inside the States, he reduced counterfeiting activity by 90%, and he tracked the remaining 10% so vigorously he got almost all of them before they'd even distributed the fakes.
He impressed me greatly. So what was the problem? I asked him.
Kelstein made a couple of precise little motions with his small white hands, like he was moving one scenario aside and introducing another.
The problem lay abroad, he said, outside the United States. The situation there is very different. Did you know there are twice as many dollars outside the U.S. as inside?
I nodded. I summarized what Molly had told me about foreign holdings, the trust and the faith, the fear of a sudden collapse in the desirability of the dollar. Kelstein was nodding away like I was his student, and he liked my thesis.
Quite so, he said. It's more about politics than crime. In the end, a government's primary duty is to defend the value of its currency. We have $260 billion abroad. The dollar is the unofficial currency of dozens of nations. In the new Russia, for instance, there are more dollars than rubles. In effect, it's like Washington has raised a massive foreign loan. Raised any other way, that loan would cost us $26 billion a year in interest payments alone. But this way, it costs us nothing at all, except what we spend on printing pictures of dead politicians on little pieces of paper. That's what it's all about, Mr. Reacher. Printing currency
for foreigners to buy is the best racket a government can get into. So Joe's job in reality was worth $26 billion a year to this country, and he pursued it with an energy appropriate to those high stakes.